For the Colorado Court of Appeals, we have one case on our docket. I see counsel are already set up. Have you had a chance to review our written procedures, and if so, do you have any questions?
No, I do not, Judge, and I believe.
We're ready to hear argument then in Elgin versus Duval.
Good morning, Your Honors. I've been trying cases since 1986. I've tried a lot of cases since 1986, and I don't think I've ever tried a perfect trial because things happen in court. But this was the most fly-by-the-seat, off-the-cuff trial that I ever had. And the reason it is because plaintiff's counsel promised, consistent with the rules of civil procedure, to have four witnesses available, plus my client was available. She called one. And because of that, because she only called 25% of the witnesses that she promised to call, the court was invited into and trying to deal with that four distinct areas of error. The first is admitting hearsay in the forms of medical records and bills, when admittedly nobody was qualified to testify or talk about that. The second is holding the defendant to a pretrial stipulation that was based on a presumed, whether explicit or implicit, that at least one of those witnesses could testify about those records, and then that witness wasn't available. The third was instructing the jury on the damages with medical bills, denying the motion for directed verdict, when the plaintiff in this case not only said, I don't know what those bills are referring to, when he is the only witness who is called and the defendant is trying to cross-examine him about that, an objection that is beyond the scope of his expertise is sustained. So the jury necessarily has to base its decision on the medical bills on its own unqualified conjecture and expertise. And then the fourth is instructing the jury on speeding when the only evidence from the plaintiff is, I never saw him and I have no evidence about what his driving conduct was. And the defendant says, I wasn't speeding. I looked away for a second. All four of those are distinct areas of error. I think when you couple that all together, while a trial judge necessarily has to have some discretion in how to run a trial when imperfections occur, when things come up, when the vagaries of human life come into play, cumulatively, this was just not a fair trial and was an abuse of discretion. The cases make it very clear that the purpose of the rules and the purpose of that discretion is to ensure a level playing field. This was not a level playing field. When viewed as a whole, the defendant was entitled to a fair trial. He was entitled to present his case. He was entitled to rely on the pretrial promises that these people were going to be coming in.
Mr. Geisling, let me stop. You've kind of mushed them all these issues together, and you're talking about now cumulative error, which you did not argue in your brief. Let's unpack the issues if
okay.
We can. First, you talk about there was error to admit hearsay in the medical bills.
Right. And medical records and medical bills.
Right, right. I'm not sure you actually made a hearsay objection below. Your argument was the medical bills shouldn't have come in without expert testimony. Now, am I correct that the judge preserved to you the right to object if expert testimony was necessary or the jury would be confused?
I don't think so, Judge. I think consistent with Rule 103, when a judge makes a defined, definitive statement that I'm ruling on this evidence, it is preserved regardless of what I do, and his analysis was A stipulation's a stipulation. It's coming in.
But the judge did say, did he not, that you can I'll let you object to them if it turns out that expert testimony would be necessary or the jury would be confused. I believe, I'll just tell you, I'm not trying to play a game with you, Mr. Geisling. I think that's in the record.
I think when he started to say that, Judge, what he was talking about in the record was, well, we can reserve it for later, but then he goes on and says, I think I may be inconsistent in my opinions. We're going to let these come in. And at that point, it's a question of whether my objection was sufficient or not. I think it was at that point. I think at that point it was sufficient. The judge had said that the records are coming in. The judge also, on top of that, at the motion for directed verdict, I made the argument, Judge, he doesn't know what these bills refer to. He can't testify to these bills, and he can't, and there's not anybody else here that has testified.
Okay, now you've moved to a different issue. Let's pick that one up on directed verdict. I'm sorry.
Well, what I was going to say is I think that that's a continuation of the objection and the basis of the objection. Understanding, I think, in fairness to me and to what was going on with the defendant, is it wasn't until just before the jury is coming in that plaintiff says, I'm not sure we have the doctor. And at that point, it's a question of, okay, you've got to respond to the vagaries of what's actually going on in court, and the judges will deal with that. I make the objection, and he says, well, the stipulation is a stipulation. And I did not interpret his statement to say you can reserve it or bring it back. I did not interpret that at all, Judge. In terms of what I was confronted with, when a judge says a stipulation is a stipulation, and then subsequently, when I'm trying to examine the plaintiff about the records, and the judge says we're staying away from medical opinions, and then you get to the point of the mid-trial motion, and the judge says, well, I'm going to let it go to the jury anyway, and it's just kind of throughout the plaintiff's case, I think, this was, you know, I didn't stand up every single time, but I think that the record and the objections were preserved all the way through. And it wasn't until after the plaintiff had completed his direct examination, the plaintiff's counsel conceded, well, I still don't have him. We're going to still try to get him. So it was a kind of a moving target, if you would.
And you were discussing that throughout. I mean, whether the doctor was going to show or not, they thought they subpoenaed him. I recall that. Well, let me ask you, you keep raising these, I have a lot of questions, and I apologize.
Okay.
In terms of the medical bills, often medical bills are put in through a custodian of records, true?
True.
And so here, let's hypothetically say that the judge, because I'll leave that maybe there's a question. If the judge said medical bills will come in, you stipulated to authenticity and foundation, at least, in the trial management order. They come in if an issue about expertise becomes relevant, I'll let you object. Let's say, for argument's sake, that happened. What's wrong with that? I mean, the medical bills would come in through, hypothetically, all you're doing was avoiding a custodian of records.
Because I disagree with that. I think that, and the reason I do is because medical bills are subject to cross-examination by an expert. Even if they're coming in subject to authentication and foundation, I get to say, Dr. Budden, take a look at what Dr. Nelson is charging here. He is charging twice on the same date for the same procedure. You've never done that, have you? Do you know of any medical reason why Dr. Nelson, who they didn't call, is doing that? And so I can cross-examine about the content and the substance. Foundation and authentication is one thing. Being able to cross-examine the expert about the substance is something else. Dr. Budnick, as an expert, is entitled to comment on these records, even if he didn't prepare them.
You never deposed Dr. Budnick.
I did not.
So how do we know what he would say on any question you would ask?
We don't.
So why isn't it just speculation as to what you would have gotten out of Dr. Budnick?
Because I'm not under a duty to depose Dr. Budnick.
No, but you're arguing that there was legal error committed here. I think you need to show prejudice. How do we know there's prejudice if we have no idea what Dr. Budnick would say?
The prejudice is in the fact that I could not confront any expert regarding these matters, and that the plaintiff, regardless of what Dr. Budnick had to say, I could cross-examine him in front of the jury. The jury could evaluate his credibility. The jury could consider whether or not his explanation was accurate or not. But what I'm left with when Dr. Budnick is not called in is I am left with a plaintiff who says, I know nothing about these materials. I didn't see them until yesterday, and I can't testify to anything about them. So I am prohibited from cross-examining him. And in this particular case, the judge found that a week before trial, I had, or a little more than that, I had expressly communicated to plaintiff's counsel, I am cross-examining your witnesses. I'm not calling any witnesses. This is all through cross-examination. And so the at that point, the whole strategy is gone, the whole trial is gone, and we get back to the question of, this is an off-the-cuff, fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants. The judge says, of course we're going forward with the trial today. We'll deal with these issues as they come up. And I think it makes, to be perfectly honest with you, and just from my own experience, in this case, to impose on me a burden of continually hitting these moving targets as they're moving along puts a kind of a form over substance. I'm supposed to do the best that I can for my client in those circumstances. These were incredibly trying circumstances for a trial attorney. They weren't there, you know, and you're trying to deal with what happens on a minute-by-minute, minutia-by-minutia deal. The judge is making rulings saying, well, we'll deal with the possible absence of Dr. Budnick as we go along, but we're going to go ahead and hear from the plaintiff now. And then we hear from the plaintiff, and at the conclusion, well, see if you can get him now. At the mid-trial motion, I think, is the proper time to say none of this stuff goes before the jury, which is what I did.
Let me try to cut to the chase here. Are you saying that as the medical records were being offered and the judge was ruling on their admissibility, there was still a question as to whether Dr. Budnick would or would not show?
Absolutely. That okay. was very clear in the record.
And that was only determined that he wouldn't show when the plaintiff rested right. without mm-hmm. producing him.
Right.
So it was only at that time that your position is only at that time you could finally say.
I think so, Judge. I mean, because the judge had made it clear that we'll keep trying to get him. You call him up. I think there's a portion in there. You call him up and say that there's going to be a contempt citation if you don't do this. And the next day it was, well, I didn't serve him, so there can't be a contempt citation. And then we get to the conclusion of the case, she rests, and that's when I say, don't let the jury consider this. I do think it was at the conclusion of the case.
Your argument wasn't don't let the jury consider this. You didn't move to strike the exhibits. You moved for a directed verdict on the grounds that there wasn't sufficient evidence of necessary and reasonable expenses, correct?
I believe that is what... Yes, Jim. Yes.
Okay. And it is, I do understand the argument you're making, Mr. Geiselinger, but there was at least some evidence from the plaintiff here as to, here's what happened to me, here's the doctors I went to. Now, to be sure, there were certain questions he couldn't answer, but he did testify at some length about what happened to him and the doctors he went to. Right?
That is correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, he did testify to that, but he also specifically said, I don't know anything about these medical records or medical bills. I can't understand it. It doesn't make sense why Dr. Nelson is charging twice. The area where the wives' medical records or medical bills were included, that was just kind of fortuitous as I'm examining him. And then the judge says, it's my job to clear up this area so that the jury won't be confused by a witness that she is objecting to me talking to about the medical records, about the documents, because they're outside the scope of his expertise. I think that this is one of those cases where the playing field just wasn't level, and it wasn't level because these witnesses were not available. And I think you create a really dangerous situation if you allow the plaintiff to say, yeah, you don't have to call your witnesses and we're going to uphold this on appeal, because then there's going to be other attorneys coming up here saying, boy, trial practice is just not, there's not this certainty, the pretrial procedure that we're relying on so that we can have fair trials and we can know what to expect, we can't rely on it anymore.
Counsel, we only have a few seconds. I just want to ask one question. I understand completely that this was a difficult situation for you and for the judge. In retrospect, what should the judge have done?
I think in retrospect, the judge probably should have said, at a minimum, we need to find out if Dr. Budnick is going to be here or not, because that's from my perspective. And if he's not going to be here, at that point, then the court goes ahead and says, all right, why is he not here? Have a contempt citation. The jury needs to hear from the doctor.
And if he wasn't going to be there, continue the trial?
Continue the trial, vacate the trial, go on, anything like that.
Thank you.
Did you move for a continuance?
I did. Prior to the week before trial,
I asked a poor question. Let me be more precise. The morning of or during the trial, when the Budnick situation deteriorates, did you say, Judge, we got to have a continuance?
At that point, it was too late because the plaintiff had elected to proceed. It then gets to because we're expecting him. She said, well, I'm not sure. It starts at 9:30 in the morning or so. She says, I'm not sure he's going to show up or not. And that's when I say, okay. And well, can't have the records. Well, we'll deal with that. And then and it goes forward. And then at mid-trial, it's he's not here and the motion is made.
I appreciate your point that it was too late. Okay.
May it please the court, my name is Lori Beck, registration number 32060. The issue before the court today is whether or not the trial court abused his discretion in allowing certain evidence into trial, and whether or not the sanctions or remedies that he imposed were proper, and whether or not the jury instruction that he allowed in was based on the evidence.
The judge didn't impose any.
And that's why I said remedies.
But he didn't impose any remedies either, did he?
Based on his comments in his findings, it was a remedy for the defendant based on the unavailability of the witnesses to allow.
Let's just stay with Budnick specifically. And your opponent cast this as an unlevel playing field. Once you failed to produce Dr. Budnick, contrary to the representations in the TMO, what did the trial judge do to tilt the playing field in favor of the defendant to accommodate your failure to produce Budnick?
And just for Budnick?
Just for Budnick.
I think he allowed the defendant to talk about the medical records. And again, the documents that were in the trial notebook weren't all from Dr. Budnick. There was just one part that was from Dr. Budnick and one bill. The rest of them were not regarding Dr. Budnick. The court allowed the defendant to talk to Mr. Elgin, the plaintiff, about the treatment that Dr. Budnick gave him and the expenses that it came from that treatment.
Didn't that have been with a cross-examination?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
But wouldn't that cross-examination have been proper based on your direct examination of Mr. Elgin, regardless?
I believe it would have been.
Okay, so I come back to my question. I don't want to unduly consume your time. Tell me anything that the trial judge did to tilt the playing field after you failed as a consequence of your failure to produce Budnick.
Again, I think the court allowed the defendant to talk to Mr. Elgin regarding the records and the treatment of Dr. Budnick.
He wouldn't have been, and that cross-examination wouldn't otherwise have been proper?
I think it would have been.
Okay, so what else did the judge do to accommodate the defense for your failure to produce Budnick, if anything?
Again, the reason that the records were allowed is because there was a stipulation. And that's why the court let those records in. I understand what you're saying, and I just feel that the court allowed the defendant to go into the testimony with Mr. Elgin regarding the treatment of Dr. Budnick in further detail than he would have been allowed to.
All right, thank you.
Let me ask you, Ms. Beck, and maybe you can help me on the record because I'm concerned if I'm making this up. Didn't the court, well, two things. The court did not let anyone discuss anything that would get in the field of expert opinion when you got in the records. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And that was one thing when there was objections about the plaintiff giving expert opinion, the court was excluding that because there was no expert there. Correct?
That's correct. And he did the same for me when I tried to go into...
Right. And am I right that the court preserved to Mr. Duval the ability to object to the medical records if it turned out that there would be need for expertise or the jury would be confused? Am I misremembering?
Your Honor, I don't honestly recall that. I do know that when there was a first concern that Dr. Budnick may not appear, the court went over that in detail and talked about, I know the issue of the medical records did come up, just his part. And the judge basically said that because we stipulated to these documents, and there was no condition on the stipulation at all, whether or not Dr. Budnick was going to be there or not. I mean, yes, we had him subpoenaed. He was supposed to appear, but unfortunately he was evading service. But I'm sorry, I totally lost my train of thought. Sorry, Judge. So...
Your observation is that implicit in the stipulation, or let me just ask this way, I gather from your colleague's argument that implicit in the stipulation was the assumption that Dr. Budnick was going to be present.
That's not how I see it. A stipulation was a stipulation, and that's what the court said. There was no written or oral conditions placed on the stipulation of the medical records and the doctor's records, or the police report that was in the trial notebook. There was absolutely no condition placed on that. In August of 2008, the authenticity and foundation were stipulated to for documents, all documents. And again, when we met on the 14th, there was no conditions placed on the stipulation that these documents would be placed in a trial notebook and would go to the jury. Now, I mean, the case law is clear in Colorado pursuant to Lawson v. Safeway that there needs not be expert opinion to have medical records come into before the jury. And basically in this case, the plaintiff testified in very in detail of which doctors he saw, what they did, how long he saw them, when he saw them, and what his bills were.
How does that establish that the treatment was medically necessary?
Again, Judge, I don't think there's any case law that says that there needs to be expert opinion to make that finding. And like I said, in Lawson versus Safeway, the court was clear that they say expert opinion is not required to show the medical costs are reasonable, necessary, and related. Yes, there are cases that distinguish that, and they're in the 10th Circuit. And one that I will point out to the court is Nyberger versus Federal Express Ground Package, where the court said, is the 10th Circuit 2009, where the court said that the plaintiff could not provide evidence of reasonable and necessary medical treatment that was related to the accident. But in that case, Your Honors, the plaintiff had prior injuries to the same part of her body. So her testimony alone could not prove that the treatment was necessary or related to the accident.
And Mr. Elgin also...
No. There were claims of some workman's comp.
That's what I meant.
Okay, yeah. He did not have the injuries that he sustained from this incident, from the accident. There's absolutely no medical records to show that he had the injuries that he sustained as far as bulging discs. Well, that wasn't in the testimony, but basically the severity of the injury. In his testimony, he says he went to the hospital because his boss made him. And that was it. They checked him out. He went back to work. There was no...
That was the workers' comp?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. The cases that the defendant relies on, which is Lighting versus Mutha, 58 P. 3rd, 1049, that talks about the court allowing an administrative law judge's report in that actually interpreted medical records. Judge, that's not the case here. Again, the medical records, not interpretation, was allowed in the jury notebook. And again, there was a stipulation. And again, it would be my argument that during the course of getting these records in, the defendant waived his right to argue prejudice of the medical billing when he only objected to the medical records of Dr. Butnick. There was no argument as far as the billing, only the medical records. And that was the first day of trial, pages 19 and 20. It is also our opinion that during trial, the defendant withdrew his objection regarding the medical records when he expressed to the court that he did not object to the medical records being admitted. And again, that was the first day of trial, which is on page 46.
You agree with Mr. Geisinger's statement that during the first day of trial, when the events you described were going on, it was not certain that Budnick was a no-show?
I agree with that, yes.
Okay, so at what, I mean, up until the time you rest, is Budnick's no-show status essentially indeterminable?
Correct. We tried to serve him over and over. We did properly serve his administrator, his office administrator, pursuant to the rules. I just, based on the history of Dr. Budnick, I wanted to make sure that we had him. And it was just, there was a feeling there, so we tried to do everything we could to get him personally served. And unfortunately, we could not. And I guess that goes to the point of how much, does a defendant or any party have a right to rely on a will call list? And absolutely they do. But to what point? Does it have to be reasonable? In this particular case, Ms. Elgin was in a Minnesota jail.
Well, I don't think that those Elgin, Ms. Okay. Elgin, and the guy in the middle car is a defense as close. Why wasn't the defendant entitled to rely on an opportunity to cross-examine Budnick in the process of trying to show that some of this treatment was not necessary or reasonable?
Your Honor, I'm not saying he wasn't.
Well, he did not have that opportunity due to circumstances under your control, correct?
Well, I don't know if it'd be under my control. I mean, we definitely tried to do our best and do due diligence. I think it hurt our case as well by not having him there to explain why he was treating Mr. Elgin the way he was treating him. So I think we are both at a disadvantage, but Mr. Elgin did a very good job of explaining the treatment that was provided to him by Dr. Budnick. And again, I just want to point out that not all exhibits were from Dr. Budnick. So it's not that everything that was stipulated to would be out because Dr. Budnick wasn't there.
And I apologize if this is clear from the record and I've just forgotten. You got approximately $40,000 for economic injuries?
Correct. And 10 for non-economic.
And about 20 of that was medical bills, round number?
I think it was like 26.5.
How much of the 26.5 was Budnick's? About.
Five. He got paid by MedPay, which was $5,000. That's where he was paid out of.
The rest of it was?
Was Dr. Nelson, was the paramedic, was the MRI, all that stuff.
Thank you.
Okay. I have nothing further. Any more questions? Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. Your time is exhausted. We will issue a written opinion in due course. On that basis, counsel are excused. Since this is our only case, the bailiff may now serve as.